Good afternoon, Juneau, all of Southeast Alaska, and anybody that's listening online via streaming. It's Wednesday, July 16th, 2014. Time for a Juneau afternoon. I'm Ken Fix. I'm your host for today. On the show, we'll be talking with Catherine Kell about the happenings at the Canvas. Nick Jans will be here to highlight the release and book signing of his new book, A Wolf Called Romeo. We'll learn about housing forum that's being conducted next week with guest Jeremy Shea. And Aaron Suring will be here with details about this weekend's Jump Society screenings. These guests, Writer's Almanac, Bird Note, Music, and more, for Wednesday, July 16th, 2014. Stay tuned. National Native News is up first.
This is National Native News. I'm Sarah Gustavus. A bipartisan group of lawmakers are trying to renew the Indian Coal Production Tax Credit, which is expected to create jobs in parts of Indian country. Matt Laszlo has the story from Washington.
In 2003, the tax credit offered Montana's Crow Tribe $2 for every one ton of coal produced from a coal facility. The credit was one of several tax breaks that expired at the end of last year during the fiscal cliff crisis. Montana Democratic Senator John Walsh says the tax credit will revive the Crow Reservation after nearly 6 months without the economic aid.
Political brinksmanship has won out at the expense of good-paying jobs and certainty for millions of American businesses and taxpayers. This particular provision not only helps tribes responsibly develop their natural resources, but it also creates and sustains jobs and economic development in Indian country to support self-sufficiency and self-determination.
Unemployment on the Crow Reservation was roughly 25% in 2012. Walsh says the renewal of the tax credit is desperately needed for Montana's Crow Tribe. For National Native News, I'm Matt Laszlo in Washington.
The Obama administration announced new initiatives today to address the impacts of climate change across the country, including in Native communities. Funding and support will go to serve state, local, and tribal programs. Last month, President Obama announced a competition to encourage the development of new models for addressing recovery and risk analysis for natural disasters. Nearly $1 billion is dedicated to the National Disaster Resilience Competition. Other programs announced today include a guide that tribes and local governments can use to assess health concerns related to climate change. And the Bureau of Indian Affairs announced the new Federal Tribal Climate Resilience Partnership and Technical Assistance Program. A school district in the Pacific Northwest has received funding to support Native students. Giselle Halfmoon has details on how the new grant will be used.
The Pendleton School District, in collaboration with the Confederated Tribes of the Umatilla Indian Reservation, has received more than $100,000 in grants from the Oregon Department of Education. Assistant Superintendent Tricia Mooney states the American Indian Alaskan Native Culturally Teaching, Learning, and Pedagogy grant funds were awarded to improve the classroom performances for local Native American students.
Our grant is titled Fostering Cultural Competence Through Collaborative Partnership. We will be focused on developing curriculum that is unique to our local tribes and tribal history and cultural responsive activities that we'll be able to use with not only students but also with staff.
In addition to culturally enhancing student curriculum and teacher proficiency, the grant provides a more developed transition for students interested in furthering their development into higher education.
We also will develop some dual credit classes through the knowledge base of, you know, tribal staff and tribal members to offer to our high school students so they could receive some dual credit courses. We're partnering with BMCC on that.
Reporting in Pendleton, Oregon, I'm Giselle Halfmoon.
Tribal conservation officers from 14 tribes recently attended a law enforcement training in Montana. Tribal law enforcement officers, including wildlife officers, must meet certain annual training requirements set by the Bureau of Indian Affairs. The training covered skills such as crime scene investigation, wildlife field forensics, and the use of force. Attendees also learned about signs of drug activity and federal laws in Indian country. The tribal officer training was led by the U.S. Fish and Wildlife Service with support from the Department of Interior and Department of Justice. Instructors also came from the Cheyenne River Sioux Tribe, the Mandan, Hidatsa, and Arikara Nation, and the U.S. Attorney's Office. The Crow Tribe hosted the training and worked with the Native American Fish and Wildlife Society. For National Native News, I'm Sarah Gustavus.
National Native News is produced at the Annenberg National Native Voice Studios in Albuquerque, New Mexico by Kawanak Broadcast Corporation, with offices in Anchorage, Alaska. Funding is provided by the Corporation for Public Broadcasting, the Annenberg Foundation, and the Ford Foundation.
Support for this program is provided by the Native American Rights Fund, reminding you that sovereignty is not free. Native American Rights Fund has been helping Indian tribes for over 40 years with critical issues such as treaty enforcement, hunting and fishing rights, Indian child welfare, religious freedom, and more. You too can become a modern-day warrior with your support for NARF's work. Learn more at narf.org and join the fight for Native rights.
Native Voice One, the Native American Radio Service.
Juno Afternoon continues. It's 3:05 p.m. My first guest is Catherine Kell, and she's no stranger to us here at the studio. She's going to be talking about the happenings at Canvas. Hi, Catherine. How are you doing today?
I'm fine. Thank you for having me.
All right. And I know there's a bunch going on this summer because I'm actually taking one of these classes here this next week. So,
oh, very cool.
Yeah, tell everybody what's coming up.
Yeah, right now at the Canvas, since the kids are out of school, we've been offering a lot of youth summer programming, two classes that are coming up that still have spaces available. We have a animal drawing workshop called Lines, Tigers, and Bears. Oh, my.
Lines, Tigers, mm-hmm. and Bears. Oh, that's pretty cool. That's
yeah.
cute.
Yeah, and it's being led by a guest artist named Jennifer Wildermuth. We're actually bringing her up from San Francisco. So this is, I think, the first time she's going to be teaching at the Canvas. It's going to be a week-long class, Monday through Friday, August 4th through the 8th. It's a morning class, 9 a.m. to noon, for ages 9 and up, and it costs $125, and that includes all materials. And in this class, basically, students are going to learn a step-by-step approach of how to draw animals realistically that can be applied to other subject matter, as well as how to capture like natural textures like fur and feathers and, you know, just really capturing the spirit of the animal on the page. Another youth class that we also have coming up that has some spots available is our Youth Leather Workshop being taught by Marianne Manning. This is also a week-long class, Monday through Friday, 1 to 4 p.m., and this one is for ages 8 and up. The class is going to be running the same week as our animal drawing class. It's going to be August 4th through the 8th. And basically the focus of this class is to teach students how, like, basically the entire, the foundation of working with leather. So, like, how to cut leather, like, the preparation, designing, how to actually, like, do tooling and, like, hand paint the leather. They're going to start off with making their own keychain, luggage tag, and belt, but there is an opportunity for students to then go ahead and pick projects that they are interested in making. For example, we had people make a custom leather book cover this past time around, which is really cool.
Nice. Well, actually, I'd be interested in making a leather belt. You can hardly find a good belt. It's like leather on top with some kind of cardboard or something flexible fiber thing in between there. I don't know. The good old-fashioned way of making them out of a one strip of leather is probably the best.
Yeah.
So, yeah, exciting to do those kind of things, especially for the younger crowd. And that one is going to be an entire week, and Marianne's teaching that one.
Yes. That's going to be August 4th through the 8th, and it's going to be the afternoon class, so 1 to 4 p.m.
Okay.
And then for our adult artists, we have two classes coming up. We have a Tlingit beadwork class being led by local artist Ricky Tagaban. It's going to be two Saturdays in a row, August 9th and the 16th, 10 a.m. to 3 p.m. And it's an opportunity for people to learn how to do embroidery and, like, basically two-needle stitching with beadwork. So you learn how to do, like, decorative border stitching and various other methods, and you apply those to make your own small pouch or wallet out of wool felt. And the class is $155, and that includes all materials. Our other opportunity for our adult artists is we have a beginning wheel class that's going to be starting Saturday, August 9th. It's also going to be a Saturday class. It's going to run the 9th through the 30th, 10 a.m. to 1 p.m. It's being led by Jenny Chamberlain. And this is a chance for people to learn the foundations of how to throw on the wheel, so like wedging and centering and, you know, throwing cups and bowls. And that class will be $150, all materials included.
All right, and what else is coming up for adults?
Well, right now, because we're
I know one that's coming up.
we have a couple more classes coming up, but they're currently full. Would you be talking about the landscape workshop?
No, the other one.
The stained glass basics class.
Yeah, that's the one I'm in.
yeah, that's going to be starting July 22nd.
Yeah, and that was limited to 8, and I'm sure you got to 8 people already.
Oh, yes, and a wait list.
And a waiting list for that. Okay, yeah, it's a good thing I jumped on that earlier this year when I could.
Yeah, but Marianne will be teaching more, we hope, more glass classes in the fall. And starting mid-August, we're going to be putting out our fall schedule, which will have a full class list.
I was just going to ask you what's coming up for the fall.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we'll switch back over to our more adult classes going back into the fall once the kids go back to school.
Okay, and remind everybody where they can find all this information and the upcoming classes.
Well, there's a couple of opportunities.
Okay.
You can either come down and see us in person. We're at 223 Seward Street, and we're right next to Pie in the Sky. And we'll have our new schedules at the front desk. You can also check out our website at www.canvasarts.org. And that's where we keep our classes. We update them on a regular basis. So if you go in there, you'll see our most current list of classes.
And all your classes are taught in that building, correct?
Yes. All of our classes are either taught in our pottery studio or in our art studio.
Okay. All right. And any other surprises or anything coming up in the fall that you know about and want to kind of flip on us here?
No surprises. We do have some really cool artists coming up for next month's gallery exhibit, Fumi Matsumoto and Kaki Shields, both two local artists. They're doing an exhibit called Paper and Print, and they're going to be featuring Kaki's doing artwork with books and folding, and Fumi's doing prints on, like, tea bags and, like, coffee filters. And, yeah, both well-known local artists, and it's going to be a really cool exhibit.
All right. Catherine Kell, as always, it's a pleasure having you here and letting us know what's going on at Canvas, and I hope to see you again really soon.
All right, thank you.
Coming from your hearts and minds, let us drown the noise.
And that was Los Lobos with Wolf. Nick Jans should be coming up here sometime within the hour, and he's going to be talking about his book release and signing for A Wolf Called Romeo. And due to the completion of construction in the Lemon Creek area, Capital Transit will resume regular service to Davis Avenue and Lemon Creek Road. Service will be discontinued on Lund Street and Central Avenue. Thank you for your understanding during the service interruptions due to construction. I think most of Juneau's under construction right now. For more information, call Capital Transit at 789-6901. And now it's time for Writer's Almanac with Garrison Keillor.
And here is the Writer's Almanac for Wednesday. It's the 16th of July, 2014. It was on this day in 1790 George Washington signed the act which established the site of the U.S. Capitol on the east bank of the Potomac River. He soon hired a French architect and city planner, Pierre L'Enfant, to design the new city. It was 10 years later that the government began moving into town, but Washington died in 1799, never lived in the city that bore his name. John Adams was the first president to occupy the White House. It's the birthday of St. Clare of Assisi, 1194, who came from a wealthy family but was deeply affected by the preaching of the young Francis of Assisi, made her vows of poverty, joined a group of Benedictine nuns, and eventually found her own order, the Order of St. Clare, who came to be called the Poor Clares. The Catcher in the Rye was published on this date, 1951, by J.D. Salinger, about the 16-year-old prep school boy Holden Caulfield, fed up with all the phonies, which became a bestseller almost immediately, number one on the New York Times bestseller list after 2 weeks, despite a disparaging review, and which has sold more than 65 million copies. The book which begins, "If you really want to hear about it, the first thing you probably want to know is where I was born and what my lousy childhood was like and how my parents were occupied and all before they had me and all that David Copperfield kind of crap, but I don't feel like going into it if you want to know the truth." It's the birthday of the founder of Christian Science, Mary Baker Eddy, born in Bow, New Hampshire, in 1821, and the birthday of the playwright Tony Kushner, born New York City, 1956, best known for his two-part play of 1991, Angels in America. And it was on this day in 1945 the first atomic bomb exploded, 5:30 in the morning, 120 miles south of Albuquerque. People saw a ball of fire that rose in the air, releasing four times the heat of the sun, followed by a 40,000-foot-high mushroom cloud. The government told people that an ammunition dump had blown up. There is a plaque there that marks the spot, and radiation levels there are still, all these years later, 10 times normal. Here's a poem for today by Todd Davis, "The Sound of Sunlight." On the far side of the canyon, light is burning through two draws, like water rushing into an empty riverbed. A canyon wren opens her mouth, and a coyote stops mid-trail before vanishing among juniper. As we descend the eastern wall, we look down onto ponderosa pine and witness the shadow of a merlin chase the merlin itself. Behind us, in the meadow where we lay last night, the squall of an elk picks up the sound of sunlight and joins it in a flood of bugling. A poem by Todd Davis, "The Sound of Sunlight," from In the Kingdom of the Ditch, published by Michigan State University Press and used by permission here on The Writer's Almanac, supported by the Poetry Foundation, publisher of Poetry Magazine, committed to discovering great poets and printing their verse. Back issues and subscriptions available at poetryfoundation.org. Engineered by Noah Smith and produced by Joy Biles. Be well, do good work, and keep in touch.
Perseverance Theater Summerfest is now playing, and for our local and loyal audiences, we now have pay-as-you-can performances on all matinees through July 20th. Bring your visiting friends and families and discover, explore, and laugh. Discover the unique friendship in the Blue Bear. Explore the history of Alaska Native warfare and Dave Hunsaker's Warriors, and laugh at the biggest Broadway comedy in years, Vanya and Sonia and Masha and Spike. Now playing Summerfest. Visit ptalaska.org or call 463-TIXS.
Welcome back to a Juno afternoon. Well, I guess you never really went away, did you? It's 3:21 p.m. I'm Ken Fix. I'm your host for today. And my next guest is Jeremy Shea, and he's going to be highlighting the housing forum for this next week called A Roof.
Hi.
Hi, Jeremy.
Yeah, so we've got a town hall discussion. We're calling it Living with Substance Abuse, A Roof Town Hall Discussion, coming up on Tuesday here at our studio at 360. We're at, you know, TV and radio station here in town. It's 360 Egan Drive is the address. You know, we're inviting the community in. We've got an expert panel of six different guests joining us. Casey Kelly from the KTOO News team is hosting, and I've just been putting the pieces together for him over the last week here. Homelessness, one of the, you know, I read a statistic just recently saying one of the national organizations estimates that about 50% of all folks experiencing homelessness, you know, have some kind of substance abuse disorder. So that's kind of the relationship here. And, of course, there's been a lot of attention focused on this in town. Yeah.
All right. And this is part of a year-long project. So how has this been under analysis for a year? I mean, we've actually observed people and, you know, kind of tracked what was going on with them.
Well, it's not exactly a study per se like that, but it's a reporting project.
Well,
you know?
It's a year-long project.
Yeah, it's a year-long project. We started in the spring, so it's kind of like a beat reporting experiment and multimedia experiment with you know, looking at homelessness and housing. This forum, this town hall discussion we're having next Tuesday is the first in a series of these town hall forums we'll be having around the state over the course of you know, the summer, the fall, probably into the spring a little bit next year. And this is the first one. We're, you know, looking at the issue kind of from a bigger perspective than just Juno. But, of course, you know, with our panel on Tuesday, it's a very Juno-focused, and there's a lot of different substance abuse and homelessness overlap as far as the services are provided in Juno. So hopefully what we learn from this will be applicable statewide.
Yeah, I see you're bringing in several people here. Jennifer Brown from the Rainforest Recovery Center, and then you're bringing in Bruce Van Dusen, who's the executive director of Polaris House, and several other people that are coming in. So it looks like it's tying everything together. Do they hope to, you know, form any kind of consensus and decide what sort of things need to be done about the homeless issue here?
Well, I don't know if we're like a decision-making body per se.
Well, not really a decision. Well, it looks like a lot of people are capable of making decisions. You got a few people that are executive directors for some major organizations.
Yeah, you know, and again, one of the things you hear over and over again, it's like a lot of these different organizations focus on one element. You know, of course, Maria Lovechuk with the Glory Hole focuses on the immediate needs of getting, you know, someone out of the cold and fed. But there's a lot of interrelated social services type issues that can contribute or be a consequence of homelessness, including substance abuse. So it should be interesting, you know, and I think there's a good recognition in the community that, yeah, homelessness is complicated. It's not as simple as just doing one. There's no silver bullet for it. You know, there's a lot of different interrelated issues that tie into it. So hopefully we'll, you know, kind of build on that understanding, and hopefully you guys will turn out and ask your questions too as well. You know, there's been a lot of attention on it lately.
All right. And this, of course, is in our studio here, right, at 360 North. Tell everybody that may not be familiar with it what kind of a setup we have, because it's relatively new.
Yeah, it is relatively new. If you've been to any of our productions lately, we've got this kind of, it feels sort of like an welcome to your, and we've got this neat welcome video, and it feels a little bit like you've just sat down at an airplane and you're being briefed on the emergency exits and things like that, but gosh, Bill Legere really knows all the details on it. There's just a couple of different pots of money that helped fund the new studio. We've used it for a lot of different shows, like Format 360 is one of the ones we launched last year. There's Arts at 360 and different musical performances we've been hosting in there. And it's a cool space. There's all kinds of... We got a couple of like robotic cameras that someone in the control room can control remotely. Nice new sound system and things like that. Yeah,
but it is a community resource, so it's sort of been available for other projects if people come in with ideas, right?
Yeah, it is. I'm trying to think who. We'll book it out to folks who need some meeting space or to have little concerts and things like that. I think Folkfest even had some performances in there.
We did. We had a few people that came in that were part of it that came in for a couple of tapings that came in through.
Yeah. Well, I should say also, if you can't join us next Tuesday at 5:30, you can. We'll be streaming it live online also at projects.360north.org/roof. So...
Yeah. All right, and again, that's Tuesday on July 22nd.
Right. Doors open at 5.
I missed it. The doors open at 5, and we will be airing the program starting at 5:30.
Right.
Okay, Jeremy, thank you very much for being our guest in the studio today.
Thanks, Ken.
How can I be sure in a world that's constantly changing?
Clinic is closed and you or a loved one don't feel well, or you have a health-related question that can't wait. What do you do? Here's the solution. Starting July 1st, Search will have a free after-hours nurse triage line for our patients in Juneau. Search's free after-hours service is available by calling 1-800-613-0560. For life-threatening emergencies, please call 911.
This message brought to you by Search, your partner in health.
Picking up the pieces of my sweet shattered dream. I wonder how the old folks are tonight. Her name was Anne, and I'll be damned if I recall her face. She left me now knowing what to do. Carefree highway, let me slip away on you. Carefree highway, you've seen better days. The morning after blues, from my head down to my shoes. Carefree highway, let me slip away, slip away on you. Pages to the times I love best. I wonder if she'll ever do the same. Now the thing that I call living is just being satisfied with knowing I got no one left to blame. Carefree highway, I got to see you, my old flame. Carefree highway, you've seen better days. The morning after blues, from my head down to my shoes. Carefree highway, let me slip away on you. Of my dream shattered sleep, I wonder if the years have closed her mind. I guess it must be wanderlust or trying to get free from the good old faithful feeling we once knew. Carefree highway, let me slip away on you. Carefree highway, you've seen the better days. The morning after blues, from my head down to my shoes. Carefree highway, let me slip away on you. Let me slip away on you. Carefree highway, I got to see you, my old queen. Carefree highway. Better days, the morning after blue, from my head down to my shoes. Carefree highway, let me slip away on you.
That was Gordon Lightfoot with Carefree Highway, and before that, I played How Can I Be Sure, which is by the Rascals. And if you like oldies from the 60s and 70s, I host the Oldies Show along with my lovely wife, and that runs from 5 to 7 p.m. on our sister station, KRNN 102.7. But right now, we're going to play a short story by Peter Griffith, who was a former U.S. Forest Ranger for the Tongass National Forest here in Juneau, and this story is called Talks with Wolves.
A friend and I were pulling Dungeness crab pots in a remote bay near Ketchikan, Alaska, on one of those fall days when a cold, rainy drizzle turns into ice pellets. We stacked the pots in the skiff and debated whether or not to make the 20-mile run back home in the sleet with our bucket of crabs or to go ashore and build a fire. As we sat in the skiff discussing the situation, we heard a low moan come from the woods a a moan that rose in volume, continuing for about 10 seconds. Norm and I looked at each other and grinned. We had just heard a wolf howl. They say wolves howl as a means of communicating with other wolves. Nobody has ever interviewed the wolves to ask them why. It seems like howling is a way for packs to call each other to the site of a kill, or a way for wolves to bond together, or a way for one wolf pack to let the others know about territorial boundaries. But I learned that this tendency to howl is useful in another way. As a wildlife biologist, I transferred from the Huron-Manistee National Forest in Michigan to the Chippewa National Forest in northern Minnesota in 1987. There I had responsibilities for wildlife recreation and fire. Unlike Michigan, there were wolves on the Chippewa. There was a pack to the north that expanded its range onto my district each winter in search of food. We would see occasional wolf tracks out in the woods and every once in a while hear about a wolf sighting. Employees would report to me that they'd seen one of my wolves. When our district reorganized how work was going to be accomplished, I suggested that we hire a new full-time wildlife biologist to work with the folks in timber management. I'd found out there was far more work than I could reasonably do well. Because timber cutting had the greatest effect on wildlife habitat, I figured we needed a full-time biologist working directly with the forester on the district. I was willing to give up that role for which I'd been schooled and trained in order for the district to improve its wildlife management program. So we hired Paul, a young man with a Ph.D. in wildlife who had extensive experience outside the agency. After a couple of years, we started getting regular reports of wolf sightings during the summer and more frequent stories about pets disappearing from backyards. We needed to find a way to take stock of the wolf population, so our new biologist, Paul, devised a howling survey to locate wolf packs. It wasn't a one-man job. It was going to take a lot of help. Now, the way he went about this was to take our folks to the International Wolf Center in Ely, Minnesota, to be trained in the art of howling. All of our employees, foresters, recreation managers, timber sale administrators, business managers, and even the district ranger learned how to howl and how to interpret wolf howls they might receive in return. On a late summer evening, small teams of employees fanned out across a district to predetermined locations. Well after dark, we would throw back our heads, cup our hands around our mouths, and cut loose with howls. Not Hollywood movie wolf howls, but a less musical effort, a long, loud monotone. Followed by two more howls just like the first, then we would wait for answers. If we heard nothing for several minutes, we would repeat ourselves and wait again. If we heard nothing after the second howl, we would go on to the next stop on our planned route. To tell you the truth, I was a bit skeptical. After my first two stops, there was no response. At the third, my companion and I howled once, twice, and then from the dark woods at the end of the gravel road, only 100 yards away, came an answer. A howl from a wolf, then quickly joined by a second. It was enough to raise the hair on the back of my neck. In the wee hours of the morning, we gathered to compare results. That night, our crews had heard 4 or 5 wolf packs. They were enthused, especially our employees in timber management who had never before been asked to help in the wildlife program. One of them described being on a darkened lakeshore at midnight, in the hot, humid night air, not a breath of wind, surrounded by the steady drone of mosquitoes. On the far side of the lake, from a small community in the Leech Lake Indian Reservation, the beat of the drums from a Chippewa tribe celebration drifted in. The crew howled, and wolves howled back at them. Our folks felt like they'd been sent back in time 200 years to the dawn of the 19th century when voyageurs paddled the waters of Indian country, trapping and trading with the Chippewa people. Howling for Wolves was an unforgettable experience for us that night. I learned a couple of things. I had given up being the wildlife biologist, something I loved doing, and turned it over to another person. But Paul had come up with a project that I was unlikely to have initiated. He had drawn all of our employees into the effort, and in doing so, they were no longer the wildlife biologist's wolves, they were our wolves. And it also made me realize that if the Forest Service was going to manage ecosystems, we couldn't parcel out pieces of the forest management program exclusively to any one set of resource specialists. The wolves didn't care whether it was a forester, a wildlife biologist, or an engineer who was hauling at them. Our goal was the understanding that every one of us was responsible for the whole ecosystem and not just one part. We had taken the first big step toward achieving that goal. It's interesting what you can learn from talking to wolves.
And that was Pete Griffin with just a little short story about wolves. I'm anxiously awaiting Nick Jan's arrival here in the studio, and he's going to be talking about A Wolf Called Romeo, which is his new book. And he's had a signing already downtown from noon to 2 p.m. The signing this evening will be at the Nugget Mall from 6 to 7:30. That is tonight for local author Nick Jans. And just doing a little research on wolves in particular, Romeo was an Alexander Archipelago wolf, which are unique to Southeast Alaska, and it's also known as an apex predator. In other words, not much goes after them. Mostly they go after other things. He's not only going to cover his first encounter with Romeo and Romeo's subsequent crush on his female lab named Dakota, but also talk about a little bit of more encounters out by the Mendenhall Glacier with Romeo. I was fascinated to find out that DNA study has eliminated all but the wolf from domestic dogs. German shepherds are closer related to the wolf DNA than any other breed of dog, and some studies infer that dogs' separation from wolf's lineage has been as long as 100,000 years ago, far longer than the earlier 10 to 20,000 year estimates. And anatomically, modern humans evolved between 100 to 200,000 years ago, according to anthropologists. So a lot of the encounters for prehistoric humans has been with wolves, and they were the first species to approach man. And, of course, they sort of hunted together and ate together. And wolves eventually evolved into the modern dogs that we know and love today. So you look at all the different breeds of dogs that man has selectively put together and come up with, but all of them can trace their lineage back to the wolf out of Southeast Asia. So anxiously awaiting Nick Jan's appearance here in the studio, but right now we're going to go to Bird Note.
This is Bird Note. The morning dove was named for the male's gentle voice. The dove's mellow cooing, to us, may sound forlorn. But seeing a morning dove evokes anything but sadness. An elegant, slender bird about the size of a robin, the dove is dressed in deerskin brown, dappled on the wings with a few black beauty marks. The male's breast shimmers with iridescent pink, a fine complement to its bright pink feet, hardly a doleful image. And as the morning dove walks across the lawn, we see that his long tail tapers to a fine point, a jaunty avian swordsman trailing his blade. Found in open habitats, along the forest edge and in suburbs, these handsome doves are a familiar sight and sound throughout much of North America. On a warm, lazy summer afternoon, the morning dove's voice seems to speak more of serenity than sadness, and of a familiar, peaceful connection to nature. Listeners support Bird Note. If you're one of them, thank you. You make these shows possible.
PM here on a Juno afternoon. My next guest is Aaron Suring. He's here with details about this weekend's Jump Society screenings.
Yeah.
Hi, Aaron. How are you?
Good afternoon.
All right. And tell everybody what Jump stands for, because I know what it is.
The Jump Society is the Juno Underground Motion Picture Society. About, I guess 12 years ago now. Wow, we've been doing it for 12 years. We did our first local festival. So all the rules back then were it had to be shortish and from Juno, and they haven't really changed. Now the time limit is 10 minutes. Every film is less than 10 minutes, and everything has to be related to Juno, whether it's made here or by people that are from here or something along those lines.
All right, and what sort of media have been used? Is it traditional film? Is anybody still using that, or are most people...
Very few. I don't think we have any film in this one.
Okay.
It's all digital, whether they're using, some people are using stuff on their phone or just a standard. There's some stop motion stuff that's done with a regular camera. Between that and there's some, that kind of stuff. Animation just drawn directly on the computers. There's a little bit of that, too.
All right. And
things
how many
have changed a little bit.
How many submissions have you gotten for this week's festival?
I don't know that I've done a complete tally, but put them all together. We're still working on that part, but it's somewhere in the 25 range, which is pretty good. We're normally in the right around 20, and this was a good crop this year. We got some good stuff this summer.
All right, and when are the showings going to take place and where?
The shows start tomorrow. They're Thursday, Friday, and Saturday at 7 o'clock, and then Friday and Saturday we also have a 9 o'clock late show. The shows are all at Goldtown Nickelodeon, right downtown there. And if you want to get tickets ahead of time, you can do that at the Alaska Robotics Gallery, which is at 220 Front Street, between the Gross Theater and the Viking Bar.
Okay. And remind everybody, is there any cost for these shows?
No, it's free. It's just all done by donations. So, come on down. And if you don't get tickets ahead of time, still come to the door. We almost always have room. We can slip people in. It's not a big deal. We just do that to try and help balance the shows a little bit. Because we didn't do that in the beginning, and it ended up being one show which is really packed, and then we had another one that was dead. So that was the reason we did that.
All right. Aaron Suring, thank you very much for updating us on the Jump Society screenings.
Yeah,
again, they're Thursday, Friday for two showings, and Saturday for two showings at the Goldtown Nickelodeon.
Yeah, it'll be a lot of fun.
Okay, thanks for being my guest today.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
Hi, my name is Phil Paramore. I host Soundings on Monday mornings at 10 a.m. on KRNN. I appreciate KRNN radio because it's fun, it's fresh, it's entertaining, and it's informative. Tune in to KRNN 102.7 FM. Thanks.
I all of a sudden looked at my watch and said,
All right, yeah, I'm here chatting with Nick Jans, who's here to highlight his release of a book called Romeo. And just a few minutes ago, I filled everybody in about a little bit of Wolf facts that I knew. I didn't want to steal your thunder, but again, we're waiting for you to show up.
Oh, I know that. I'm sorry. This is after all these years, especially.
Well, that's okay. I got here in March of 2009, so I was here sort of right at the end of the Romeo story. Mm-hmm. I knew who Romeo was.
Right.
And everybody that's listening, if they're not acquainted with the story, can you relate the first time that you encountered Romeo?
Well, the first time that I saw the wolf was in December of 2003, and... It was the first time I had a direct visual on. I was actually sitting in the hot tub on the deck of my house looking out toward the glacier. At that time, we lived in the last house for the glacier on the west side. And having lived in the Arctic for 20 years and followed wolves and tracked them, and knowing firsthand how elusive they were, just having this wolf just pop up, having moved all the way from there to Juneau and gotten married and kind of gotten ensconced in what was, you know, comparatively Alaska suburbia, I looked up and there's this 120-pound black wolf. And not only that, but when I skied out, he didn't run off. He just kind of sat down in the willows, and the next thing I knew, he was out there approaching people with dogs. And from there, the story went on. And for 6 years, this wild wolf, who remained wild that whole time in his own way, became sort of a fixture out there on the lake, playing with people's dogs, interacting with people sometimes. And it was really just an unheard of experience and unparalleled, not only in Alaska, but anywhere in the world where you have a large apex carnivore who is free ranging, and not just for a matter of a few days, but for years, manages to stay out of trouble, not push the buttons that get him removed. You know, and of course, managing agencies were looking at him, and wolves have always been a hot button issue, and it affected the entire town of Juneau, really.
All right, and I wanted you to do a little bit of description about your first encounter with Romeo when he sort of had a crush on your female lab named Dakota, because I'm being a dog owner myself. I mean, I have two Dobermans. They're not with me anymore. But, you know, I know how I would feel if my dog was running towards a wolf. You know, that heart-stopping moment where you're wondering, oh, my God, what has my dog just gotten themselves into?
Oh, yeah. You know, and I think probably the best thing, since I have the page open here, is with a moaning whimper, I'm reading directly from the prologue, Dakota suddenly wrenched free of the two fingers I'd hooked through her collar and bounded straight at the wolf. A tone of desperation sharpening her voice, Sherry called again and again, but there was no stopping that dog. The lab skidded to a stop, several body lengths short of contact, and stood tall, her own tail straight out, as we watched, mouths open, and the wolf lowered his to match. With the two so close, I had my first clear idea of just how large the wolf really was. Dakota, stocky, traditional-style female lab, weighed in at a muscular 56 pounds. The black wolf towered over her, more than double her weight. Just his head and neck matched the size of her torso. 120 pounds, I figured. Maybe more. The wolf stepped stiff-legged toward Dakota, and she answered. If she heard our calls, she gave no sign. She was locked on and intent, but utterly silent. Not at all her normal, happy lab self. She seemed half-hypnotized. She and the wolf regarded each other as if each were glimpsing an almost forgotten face and trying to remember. This was one of those moments when time seems to hold its breath. I lifted my camera and snapped off a single frame. As if that tiny click had been a finger snap, the world began to move again. The wolf's stance altered. Ears perked high and held narrow, he bounded forward a body length, bowed on his four legs, then leaned back and lifted a paw. Dakota sidled closer and circled, her tail still straight out. The eyes of each were locked on the other. With their noses a foot apart, I pressed the shutter once more. Again the sound seemed to break a spell. Dakota heard Sherry's voice at last and bounded back toward us, turning her back, at least for now, on whatever call of the wild she just heard. We watched for long minutes with Dakota softly whining at our sides, staring toward the dark, handsome stranger who stood staring our way and whining back, a high-pitched keening that filled the silence. Half-stunned, Sherry and I murmured back and forth, wondering at what we'd seen and what it meant.
All right, and I know that's kind of a heart-stopping moment when your pet beloved runs out towards this wild animal.
Oh, yeah, it's just crazy.
And it's like, oh, great. Now it's like, what am I a witness to here? And you were actually a witness to probably one of the first and closest encounters between one of, you know, something that's deeply associated with us, our pets, and something that's totally wild.
Yeah, you know, and I would say that it was it was one encounter, but the fact is that this was happening with a bunch of people. There were a number of people who were having close encounters, and everyone was sort of keeping it their own.
Yeah, had you known that at the time, or was it like all suddenly you started discovering other people as you were out walking the trail?
Well, I think it all happened simultaneously.
Okay.
It happened. The wolf was there suddenly, and I think from what I can gather, and not only that, but I skied every day on the lake. And I know what a wolf track looks like. And as soon as I saw the first fresh wolf track before I saw the wolf. And it seemed that everything happened then. But he suddenly appeared as if he'd been dropped from the sky, as if he were a unicorn. He appeared. And it wasn't as if there hadn't been wolves around. That spring, months before, a female wolf had been hit by a cab out in the Glacier Spur Road and killed, and she was pregnant. And there were not rumors, but stories of a wolf being sighted in Dredge, a black wolf, on and off. And I'm sure it was the same animal. And whether or not that was his mate or a relative, could have been his sister, could have been an aunt. Because wolves, of course, are family guys. And a young wolf like that, as he was certainly at the time, a two-year-old, there's a good chance that he wouldn't have had a mate then, because young wolves, just like teenagers, don't usually get to start a family.
Right. And this is an Alexander Archipelago wolf.
Well, we could say that in that he was de facto in the Alexander Archipelago, but usually Alexander Archipelago wolves are little guys.
Mm-hmm.
And this was a big wolf by any standard, and what biologists up north refer to as a moose wolf, a big-boned, tall, heavy animal, really pretty much double the size, say, of the average Alexander Archipelago wolf, commonly seen on Prince of Wales Island, for example, where they're, 50 to 70 pounds.
They're more the size of a conventional, large dog rather than
right.
This one.
And I've seen them, but it didn't mean he still wasn't an Alexander Archipelago wolf. But on the other hand, all you had to do was cross over the ice field from the Atlin side. And wolves are known to wander a long way. He sure seemed to look more like a typical interior wolf.
Yes, and how did your wife wind up naming him Romeo?
Well, she just looked out the window one day, and this was after the wolf had been there for a few months on and off, or at least I think probably 6 weeks is more accurate. And there the wolf was, curled up about 100 yards from our back door, waiting for Dakota to appear or any other dog to appear, but he especially seemed to stay right in front of our house. And she looked out of the window and said, well, there's that Romeo wolf again. And it was more of a descriptive term than as a name. But we started using it ourselves. And Sherry, working at a dental office and cleaning seemingly a third of the town's teeth, the story just kind of spread from there. And the name spread. And it stuck because it seemed to fit the animal.
Right. And the story has a sad ending. And I wanted to remind everybody, actually you can do that, where your next book signing is.
Well, I'm going to be at Hearthside Books tonight, and I'm not just doing a signing. I'm doing a slideshow, a reading, and discussion. It'll start at 6 and end around 7:30 when they throw us out of the mall. And also on July 25th, if you can't make this one, and take a look at this weather. I don't blame anyone for being out and getting into this sunshine, especially after the summer we've had here. On July 25th, I'm on my way back from Seattle, and I'll be at the Downtown Public Library also at 6, and it'll also be sponsored by Hearthside Books.
Okay, great. Nick Jans, I'm so happy that you got a chance to be on the air here real fast. Tonight's forecast, mostly cloudy, slight chance of rain with lows in the 50s. That's pretty much standard for around here. And K2O broadcasts on 104.3 and a bunch of other translators. You can pick us up all over the place and on GCI Digital Cable. And just a reminder, not all humans are mean or evil. Most of us are kind-natured and have good intentions, not only towards ourselves, but fellow human beings and the other creatures that share the world with us and the beauty of nature that surrounds us. I'm Ken Fix. I've been your host for Juno Afternoon, and now it's time for All Things Considered.
It's called Speaking Freely. You said that when you were going to college in the mid-1950s, you were actually not that much of a First Amendment supporter. So what